This is Car Expert.
The Palisade isn't an off-roader, but it is available with all-wheel drive and a diesel.
Fuel use and servicing, you've saved between $4,500 and $5,000 over the Rio on top of an $8,000 price difference.
I'm personally disappointed that Hyundai is not bringing both the hybrid and the plug-in like Kia is. I think what Kia's done is a really, really good move.
G'day, my name's Mandy Turner, and a big hello to Mike Costello.
Hello, Mandy.
And James Wong.
Hello, hello. How are we?
Well, I think we're all a bit flat out because we're coming up to the end of the year and we're all taking a bit of a break, but Car Expert needs to still tick along. Mike, you've been writing an interesting article about car brands going up against car dealers. What's this all about?
Yeah, it's been like a little bit of a schoolyard fight. So all of this year, and in fact, for the last few years, the representative body for car dealers in Australia has been saying, you know, whenever they negotiate with car brands about changes to their dealer agreements, that the car brands have more power than they do, and it's a stacked debate. And they've asked the government to step in. There's been a big Senate inquiry happening this year into the conduct of car brands and the way they deal with their dealers. And this week, the government put out what it's calling six principles. So rather than binding findings, it's saying these are the six things that we think car brands should be doing to keep their franchise dealers happy. And it's quite funny. And sometimes there's an old adage about government policy. If you really piss off both sides, you're probably about right. And if that's true, then the government has succeeded spectacularly because its decision has actually grossly annoyed both the dealers and the car brands in equal measure and pleased basically nobody. So there's some quotes here from the AADA, which is the representative body for the car dealers, have said that just when we thought this year could not get worse, Minister Karen Andrews has sided with multinational car manufacturers, some of which have treated Australian dealers and their customers with absolute disdain. What we have is a do-nothing policy cynically released on a Friday afternoon. He says that it comes from ignorance and that it is a kick in the guts to all of the members of that particular group, which are pretty strong comments. So you'd assume that the other side, the Federal Chamber of Automotive Industries, which looks after the car brands, would be happy. But they're not happy either. They've said that the government's principles and policies are unhelpful, that government intervention is needed where there's a clear market failure not to halt progress. And they've basically given them just as big of a slap in the other direction. And you know, people who cover the industry like me have kind of been sitting back, just sort of speaking to each side, getting inflammatory comments about the other. It's been a really dramatic argument. And the headline for the story was War of Words Erupts Between Car Brands and Dealers and the Government Enrages Both, which kind of sums it up. So very entertaining, although I don't know how productive it is, to be honest with you.
what's your personal opinion on this?
Look, I think we've seen with the likes of Holden that, you know, sometimes car manufacturers can be pretty unprofessional in the way they deal with their dealers. Most people would be aware that most car dealers have nothing to do with the car brands other than a franchise relationship, so they're their own independent companies. And often what happens is when a big giant multinational wants to change the terms of an agreement, a little old dealer can't compete. Of course, a lot of dealers are very big and have a lot of money of their own and can push back with some veracity. So I think you've probably got a position at the moment where there are a couple of brands that are acting poorly, a couple of bad actors, and the dealer body basically wants to punish every brand, which seems counterintuitive. So I'd much rather them just focus on brands like Holden, who, you know, quite clearly did do some less than desirable behaviours, punish them and leave the other brands alone until they themselves do something wrong would be my preference rather than these broad sweeping statements. But if you want to get attention and column inches and you want to get noticed, well, you kind of have to say outlandish things sometimes. So there's probably bigger political games happening as well.
So much happening with the government, though, in 2020 with cars, isn't it?
Oh, it's been a monster year for that.
A lot of people not agreeing with it.
Yeah.
Yeah, unbelievable. Is the story published now?
Yeah, it's up and about now. So if you're into the industry stuff, go and check it out and have a look and let us know what you think in the comments.
Time for the biggest car news that has broken over the week. And James, we start off with you. We have the initial specifications for the 2021 Hyundai i30N.
Yes, so I was very fortunate to break, you know, get the scoop on this stuff. So managed to get my hands on a confidential dealer bulletin from Hyundai, which detailed all the initial specifications for the updated i30N. I know that there are a lot of people that are keenly awaiting the pricing and specifications of this car. Unfortunately, we couldn't get pricing details, but we do have a pretty good idea of what the range is going to look like when it arrives in about March or April next year. So like the current model, there will be three basic trim levels. So at the moment, what Hyundai is doing is they have a base car, which is, you know, the N or N Performance, and then you can add a luxury pack or a luxury pack and a sunroof. So it's going to be a similar sort of model walk, but now those two option packs will become sort of standalone variants, and that's probably more for marketing purposes than anything, or just more for simplicity for the buyer when they walk into a showroom. So there's going to be three grades: the i30N, the i30N Premium, and i30N Premium with sunroof. So very creative. The new model obviously gets an uprated engine, so now it produces 206 kilowatts and 392 newton meters, which is a minor kilowatt bump by about 4 kilowatts, but it's just under 40 newton meters more powerful than the old one. And then also for the first time, there will be an automatic option. So there'll be an 8-speed dual clutch automatic available as an option on certain grades. So the base i30N will be available both with the 6-speed manual or with an 8-speed dual clutch automatic. The i30N Premium without the sunroof is only available with the manual, and then the i30N Premium with the sunroof is only available as an automatic. Don't ask me why. I thought it was strange too, but that's just according to this document, that's what's going to happen. So the other key things here are, you know, we've got a whole list of standard features that are anticipated to come with this new model. But the key changes here, obviously, other than the mild design refresh, is some extra technology and obviously the dual clutch auto. So standard equipment changes that we know that are coming are the new 10.25-inch widescreen infotainment display with inbuilt satellite navigation. Unfortunately, it doesn't have wireless Apple CarPlay and Android Auto like some of the smaller screens that are coming out in Hyundai and Kia's latest models. Again, don't know why that's the case, but we'll just roll with it. And then they've also managed to fit blind spot monitoring and rear cross traffic alert to all models, which is something that the pre-facelift was missing and continues to be an omission on N-line models with that similar body kit. Something to do with the rear bumper design. Not sure why they haven't been able to amend that. But also the DCT models get avoidance assist upgraded versions of those systems. So, for example, with your blind spot monitoring, instead of just beeping and flashing a light at you when a car's approaching you from your blind spot, it will probably, I'm assuming it also does a steering correction or something like that to keep you in your lane and stop you from hitting that car that's in your blind spot. And then in the case of rear cross traffic alert or assist, when it detects a car, it won't just flash at you, it would actually almost do like an AEB function where it stops the car. As for pricing, as I said earlier, we don't know what it's going to cost. At the moment, the range starts at just over $41,000. And I imagine with the extra equipment, the extra grunt, it'll probably cost a little bit more. It's also got cool new features like 19-inch forged alloy wheels, which are meant to save like 20 kilos. And then the premium gets these awesome new seats, which are like these cool racing buckets, which again save a little bit of weight. So there's a few new features in there that I'm assuming will carry a bit of extra cost, but I can't imagine it being anywhere north of 45,000 plus on roads, maybe perhaps for the DCT, because that'll carry a premium. And then there'll also be a few colors available, so that bright performance blue will return, as will polar white, shadow gray, dark knight, phantom black, and engine red. At the moment, phantom black and dark knight carry a $495 extra charge over the base price, and I would assume that will continue. But yeah, I think there'll be a lot of people excited for it. We published it to our socials and got lots of comments, and it seems like a lot of people were excited about it in the comments on the article as well. So yeah, looking forward to that.
I do notice, Wonga, you know, Hyundai was copying a lot of flack in the comments about the fact that you can only get a sunroof with the auto and a non-sunroof with the manual. And I wish people would understand just a little better the complexities of being a car manufacturer, having to stock you know, 100,000 different variants of cars is extraordinarily difficult, which means you'd have to make them special order, which would mean it would take 6 months to get them. So unfortunately, when it comes to speccing its cars, Hyundai is kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place, and a few people are going to get left behind. But I think overall, this is the kind of facelift this car really needed. The i30N blew us away when we first drove it. You know, as a Nürburgring-tested, standalone, hardcore hot hatch, I think it went above and beyond what we thought the brand was probably capable of at that time. And obviously, the 8-speed DCT is the thing that we all really want to try. But I really think that the other area that needed improvement was the interior layout. It was always a bit drab before. It didn't have a lot of life to it. And the new one seems to be a lot better. Not just those seats, but that big new screen looks the part, certainly more modern than the one that came before it. The rest of it looks pretty much the same. But I think the facelift seems to address most of the areas of complaint. And if they can keep the pricing right, it looks like a really nice evolution of an already excellent car.
Yeah, for sure.
All right, we're going to move on. I am actually really excited about this as a bit of a Porsche lover. The brand is returning to Le Mans with an LMDH prototype. And pretty much they're, it's like Audi as well, developing a car for this hybrid category. So from 2023, it's only a couple of years away now, it'll participate in a new top class in the FIA World Endurance Championship and the North American IMSA WeatherTech Sports Car Championship. As per the class regulations, the hybrid prototypes has a minimum weight of 1,030 kilograms and also uses a 50 kilowatt Bosch hybrid system with a total output of 500 kilowatts, which is absolutely insane. Porsche has yet to announce the specs of its racer engine. No doubt it will be mind-blowing. And as we know, Porsche has had an incredible reputation with wins at Le Mans, holding the record for 19 at the 24-hour of Le Mans. What do you guys reckon of this? I think it's many, many years overdue.
Yeah, well, I think it's pretty cool that a brand like Porsche that has huge motorsport history is returning to a premier championship like the FIA World Endurance Championship. It looks really cool, this new prototype, and it sort of evolves the design from some of their previous cars, like the 919 Hybrid, which also has set several track records around the world at Nürburgring, Spa, and the like. And I think it's really cool that now they're doing all this hybrid stuff. So I'm pretty sure Toyota is also developing a hybrid car prototype for Le Mans and will actually spawn a road-going version. So it'd be really cool if we saw like a road-going version of this. Can you imagine we go back to like the 90s where those homologation specials, like that's what I love about the GR Yaris, which is completely different league to these things. But, you know, back in the 90s when we had stuff like the CLK GTR and the Toyota GT1 and things like that, and, you know, you get on Gran Turismo 3 on PlayStation 2 and all of those homologation specials were like road cars. And I just remember lusting for those things. And so it'll be really, I guess, a technological showcase for brands like Porsche who enter these events and, you know, they have to have a certain weight, a certain power output, and, you know, but they have to integrate a hybrid system and, you know, the engines have to be tuned for endurance and stuff. It's just really, really cool. And I imagine someone like Paul, who's an engineer, would just go like, you know, nuts for this kind of stuff. So it's very exciting. I know Porsche fans like yourself, Mandy, would be very excited. And I know a lot of people who are sort of embracing this new age of motorsport, I'm sure, are very, very excited as well.
I do always get a kick out of you referencing cars from the 90s, Wongy. Weren't you like born in 1995?
94. So I did. Right. I caught on to the tail end of that. But I watched a lot of TV shows and appreciated a lot of cars in video games from a very young age, which was post the turn of the millennium. So, you know, I like to think it's still fresh in my mind. I'm not that old. I'm eternally 12 or whatever. You know, I'm going to use whatever excuse I can to say that I was a firm car fan in the 90s. So, you know, don't take it away from me.
I love it.
I did really like a quote in this story from Michael Steiner, who's the board member for R&D for Porsche. He said, in the medium term, Porsche focuses on three different drive concepts: fully electric vehicles, efficient plug-in hybrids, and emotional combustion engines. We want to represent this trilogy in both the development of our cutting-edge road cars and in motorsport. So basically, you're talking about the fact that, you know, this plugs a nice gap for them because they've obviously got the electrification strategy that's going forward at a rate of knots. We all know their combustion stuff. We all know their road-going hybrids, but this sort of plugs another area for the business. So there's clearly massive R&D potential from this perspective. So the things that they learn from making this race car are clearly going to trickle down ever more into the road cars, which I guess is kind of the point of series like this. So I think, you know, we're not going to see a homologation special of this particular car on the road, but we're definitely going to see some of those features trickle down.
Super exciting. Now, we're going to talk to Scott Colley very soon about his review of the Hyundai Palisade. But, Jawo, a bit of sad news for its little bit smaller cousin, the Santa Fe FEV. It's not coming to Australia.
Yeah, so an interesting announcement out of Hyundai this week. Obviously, we know that Kia, which is a subsidiary of the Hyundai Motor Group, is bringing the Sorento in both hybrid and plug-in hybrid forms, and the Sorento essentially is the twin under the skin to the Santa Fe. But Hyundai Australia has announced that they're going to skip the plug-in hybrid version of the Santa Fe and focus on the hybrid version instead. And it looks like they might do something similar for the Tucson, which is their mid-size SUV, which is a little bit smaller again, but it hasn't confirmed exactly what will come and when. So at the moment, the hybrid Santa Fe, which is similar, you know, similar in concept to a RAV4 hybrid, but obviously a bigger car, will be in Australia during the second half of next year. But the plug-in hybrid's off the cards for now. But I think Hyundai sort of left it open-ended, saying that they consider everything and will continue to study the market. Regardless, both the plug-in hybrid and the hybrid versions of the Santa Fe and also the Sorento both draw upon a 1.6-litre turbo petrol engine as well as an electric motor and lithium-ion battery. The main difference between the two variants is that, A, you can't plug the hybrid in, which is obviously in the name. So there's that. And then the normal hybrid is a little bit less powerful than the plug-in. So what we'll be getting is an SUV that has 169 kilowatts of power and 350 newton meters of torque, and it will be all-wheel drive. So Kia hasn't actually confirmed whether the hybrid version of the Sorento, for example, will be all-wheel drive, but Hyundai is committed to the all-wheel drive version, which will be a good thing for those who perhaps don't want the diesel version but still want all-wheel drive, because at the moment we don't get the all-wheel drive option for the V6 in either version of the Santa Fe or the Sorento. So that'll be part of Hyundai's big electrification rollout next year. So they're planning to bring in most of their Ioniq products. So currently we have the Ioniq hatchback, which is a small car that's offered in hybrid, plug-in hybrid, and all electric forms. But next year, Hyundai is introducing an Ioniq sub-brand that will have several different models that are all electric. So they're pretty much committing to all electric models and normal hybrids in Australia. This is sort of, while sad for people who might have been hanging out for the plug-in hybrids, I think because Hyundai is really committing to some form of electrification in Australia, the Santa Fe will really serve as a good competitor to something like the next generation Toyota Kluger. So obviously Toyota owns the hybrid space in Australia at the moment and has done for a long time, because they were pretty much the only manufacturer playing in that space, at least from a mainstream brand perspective. So I think what is going to be really important for Hyundai, and to a similar extent Kia, when they bring in those cars to Australia, I think it's very important that it's not just hybrid can't be a trim level. It has to be a powertrain option. So the same way that you have V6 and diesel options with, you know, obviously drivetrain discrepancies here and there, I think it needs to be, you know, you can either get the diesel with all-wheel drive, or you can get the hybrid with all-wheel drive, and that way you have two efficient options and you can sort of tie them to if it's not the base variant, at least from mid-spec up, that you just offer that option. Because otherwise, if the hybrid and the normal Santa Fe Highlander as a diesel is, you know, nudging 70 grand on the road, if the hybrid was only to be offered as a Highlander, you know, and 70 grand on drive away and, you know, plus whatever else, I don't think anyone's going to buy them. So it's within their interest to make sure that there's affordable options so that people are sort of tempted to take a chance on it.
I think I'm becoming increasingly convinced that Plug-in hybrids are quite hard to justify in Australia. This is not a position I've held forever, but, you know, in Europe where they've got CO2 caps and you get taxed more if you have a car that uses X amount of grams of CO2 per kilometre, the fuel claims of plug-in hybrids being so low, even though they're not really realistic, make a lot of sense for people. But in Australia, just to give you a bit of an idea, I recently had a plug-in hybrid Mercedes-Benz GLC. I charged it every single night from my PowerPoint, did my 40Ks of electric-only driving until the battery was flat. And then after that, the petrol engine had to do most of the heavy lifting, and it had to carry around all those big heavy batteries in the floor. The average fuel consumption all up was 6.5 litres every 100 for the time I had it. Then you look at a Toyota RAV4 hybrid, which can't really drive all electrically for more than a K or so, and only then at very low speeds. But it also doesn't have to lug around all that extra battery weight, and you'll easily average 5.5 to 6 litres every 100. So I think there's a real argument that for most people, especially from a complexity perspective and from a tax perspective, to say that a normal hybrid for the average family buyer actually kind of makes a heck of a lot of sense right now. And the FEV just adds a lot of complexity for not a lot of sales return. As much as it kind of pains me to say that, I just don't think we're a country that's set up particularly well for them, although I'm sure plenty of people disagree.
Well, I have to actually butt in there and just sort of present an opposing argument there, Mocha.
Please do.
Because while I agree with you to a certain extent, I think one of the issues is that most brands don't even do normal hybrids anymore. That was a technology that was sort of new and in vogue everywhere else quite a while back. You know, you look at Japan and all of the Japanese brands have been doing that kind of hybrid tech for a very long time. And other than Toyota, no one really played in that space, perhaps other than Honda with the Accord, which was a bit of a sales flop because it was too expensive. Hyundai has offered normal hybrids of its models elsewhere, hasn't really been able to get the price down, hasn't offered it. And you look at all the European brands, they're going straight to plug-in. And so the problem is that, you know, the Australian market's been quite slow on electrification to start off with. We're finally coming around to normal hybrids, which to a lot of countries is already 5 to 10 years old, and to a lot of manufacturers as well. We're going to start missing out on plug-in hybrids, or we already have, because companies like the Volkswagen Group aren't bringing them here because A, we don't have emissions targets, and B, no one would buy them. And then, you know, now some state governments are planning to introduce taxes on EVs and going to make them more expensive. So brands will either attempt to offer something here, it'll be far too expensive for the average Australian family, so they just won't sell any, or that some brands might just not bring them at all because they're like, well, why are we going to get taxed for something that's meant to be bringing, you know, economic and health benefits and the other related things that those kind of cars bring. So I think, you know, my personal standpoint on it is that I think there's a place for all of these different technologies in all markets, not just ours. And I think especially with the case of Australia, one of the things that Australians like to do, and I feel like this is going to be a bit more prevalent post-COVID lockdowns, is we love road trips. Our country is vast. We have, you know, we sit on the highway for ages driving interstate or to country towns. Like, you know, Mandy, you're from Shepparton. Just to get to Melbourne for you when you go back home is a 2-and-something-hour drive. Your parents live interstate and you tend to drive up there. That's a really long drive, you know, and having to stop every few hours to charge your electric vehicle for 30 minutes to 60 minutes might, in my mind, is very inconvenient. I'd prefer to do just like, you know, a 5-minute fuel stop or whatever. And I think that's where a plug-in hybrid really serves our market very well, is that you have the best of both worlds. You are able to have the convenience of a combustion engine that can be refueled in seconds, and you know, when you're in town and you're being conscious about your environmental impact and your emissions, you can use the electric power for your daily commutes. And most plug-in hybrids now offer about 50 k's of range, which is more than the average commute. So I just think that, yes, I understand everyone's sort of circumstances and needs from a car like that are obviously going to differ. But I think having as much choice as possible can only be a good thing. So I'm personally disappointed that the Hyundai is not bringing both the hybrid and the plug-in like Kia is. I think what Kia's done is a really, really good move, and I would hope that other brands try to follow that, and hopefully the buying public react to that in a positive way and try to buy all different variants and show that there's a demand for that stuff here. But I just think that, you know, just because some people don't want it or don't see the value in it, then not
bringing it here, which, you know, just like you were saying before, Moko, with the i30 not having a sunroof for one transmission and not for the other, it's sort of just like cancelling out that choice, because there is a market for everything here, just on varying degrees. So I just think it's worth offering as much as we can get.
Some interesting thoughts there. If you agree with any of you guys or disagree with them, podcast@carexpert.com.au. We'd love to hear from you. And lastly, we're going to stick with some electric news, Moko. The first model, a Mercedes-Benz electric vehicle architecture, the EQS, is going into production next year.
Yeah, so Benz has already got one electric vehicle in Oz, the EQC, the SUV, but that is based on kind of a modified version of an existing platform, which is used under the GLC, albeit one extensively changed. Whereas these new products are on an entirely bespoke EV-only architecture. Mercedes-Benz obviously didn't get the jump on the luxury EV space. That was Tesla that really dominated that. But Benz now wants to kind of claim what it sees as its rightful position on top of the heap. It wants to be 100% carbon neutral by around 2040. It's fitting a lot of its new plants with renewable energy and things like that. And it's also pledged 6 new EVs to come. As you said, Mandy, first of these being the EQS. Basically, it's going to sit alongside the S-Class. So we've seen the new S-Class limo previewed or actually launched earlier this year. The EQS is a much slinkier, sportier looking, meaner looking, frankly, based on the sort of spy images that we've been seeing. Car with up to 700 Ks of claimed driving range. So really good for those people who really have that classic case of range anxiety. And you can absolutely expect this car to be a real tech leader when we see it at the start of next year. Entering production in Sindelfingen in Germany, because Mercedes doesn't necessarily use the S-Class as the tech leader for its range that it used to. So everything that it was going to do in the next decade, it used to debut in the S-Class, but things move so quickly now that it doesn't work that way. But I guarantee you that this new EQS will be the most sophisticated Benz of them all. And then we're going to see the EQA and EQB lob, which are essentially electrified or electric versions of the GLA and GLB SUVs. So sitting at the other end of the lineup. And I think there's 6 or 7 new models coming in the new EV family over the next couple of years, many of which will be geared towards China, but you can safely bet that most of them will also be geared towards Australia, because Mercedes-Benz Australia has been a pretty big supporter of the EV rollout whenever it can, be they FEVs or be they EVs. So we'll start to see some of that product coming in the next year or so. And look, at the end of the day, when Mercedes-Benz decides to start doing something, it usually does a pretty interesting job of it. So really looking forward to seeing that car.
I'm just waiting for them to market the EQS as the S-Class of electric vehicles, because they already do that with the GLS, saying it's the S-Class of SUVs. So just mark my words.
Or they do with the EQC, they go, electric finally has a Mercedes. Yeah. It's kind of funny, like they're borderline arrogant, definitely overconfident. I guess they kind of feel like they've earned that spot. I mean, Carl Benz, obviously the pioneer of pretty much all things automotive alongside Henry Ford. Mercedes-Benz, if you ask the average layperson who doesn't like cars, name a car brand, I reckon a lot of them would probably say Mercedes-Benz. I guess it sees itself as the world leader, and you have to admire the confidence, right? Let's just hope that the product lives up to the hype.
Yeah, certainly going to be a busy couple of years for Mercedes-Benz. Click the Car News link at the website if you want to read up more on those stories. To talk about this week's car review is Scott Colley. Hello.
Hello, gang. How are we?
Very good, thank you. You're talking about Hyundai's biggest family SUV. It is here in Australia, and I'm super keen to hear all about it. What were your first impressions?
It is big. That's what really stands out to start with. We flew up to Sydney to drive the car, and they had a row of them parked in front of Hyundai's headquarters. And, yeah, it's not short on presents. It's got a giant chrome grille and pretty distinctive headlights and a really boxy profile. So if you're after sort of big American truck style on-road imposing presence, the Palisade ticks that box to start with. But obviously there's a bit more to it than that as well.
What sort of car would you compare it with?
So Hyundai is trying to split the gap between things like the Mazda CX-9 and its own Santa Fe as well, which are 7-seaters that, although they're technically big enough to hold 7 people, the third row seats really are best for children or for part-time use. So it's sort of, it's bigger than some of those cars, although it's similar to a Nissan Pathfinder dimensionally. And it also wants to steal sales away from cars like the Toyota Prado and the Ford Everest, which are diesel-powered four-wheel drive body-on-frame off-roaders. The Palisade isn't an off-roader, but unlike the CX-9 and the Pathfinder and a few of those other big seven-seat family SUVs, it is available with all-wheel drive and a diesel. So Hyundai sort of wants people who want a big family hauler and they're not sure whether they want a petrol or a diesel and an on-road or an off-road car, and it's sort of a... Think of it as a little Goldilocks zone between the two is what Hyundai's targeting. And to do that, it's given you, the choice between petrol front-wheel drive and diesel all-wheel drive. And then there's a base Palisade model that starts at $60,000, and it tops out at $75,000. So it's priced on the high end of the Santa Fe segment at the bottom end of its range. And at the top end, it's a little more expensive than most of those cars.
So, Scott, you briefly touched on just there about how the Palisade sort of is bigger than those three-row SUVs that have a third-row best left for kids. Obviously, you're much bigger than the average child, let alone an average adult. But that third row in the Palisade, is it closer in size to, say, a Kia Carnival, or is it still on the smaller side? Because you can also get this as an eight-seater, which is something unique in that segment.
It's definitely still not a pure people mover. I've sat in the back row of a Honda Odyssey and also a Kia Carnival, and those cars are just so impressive because they are essentially vans on wheels, although they're unibody cars. Every bit of space has been maximized to fit people. The Palisade slots somewhere in between something like a Santa Fe and something like a Carnival, in my opinion. I did have a sit in the third row, and with the backrest of the second row slid forward because the bases slide and the backrest reclines and sits up, there was actually enough space for my legs. My headroom was obviously a problem, and that's often the case in these SUVs because there's suspension and all-wheel drive bits and pieces underneath the floor. There's less space than in something like a Carnival where you can sit people right on the ground and there's less impedance on headroom. But, yeah, I think somewhere between the Carnival and something like a Santa Fe or a CX-9 is probably the best comparison for it. In terms of the eight-seat thing, it really does feel like you could fit eight people in there, although I think the people in the third row would want to be narrower children than, broad-shouldered, fully grown men. But the seven-seater is where the real action is because it gets these beautiful captain's chairs in the second row, and if you pay for the Highlander, they're heated and ventilated as well. So Hyundai made a big deal of the fact that the Palisade can actually take five child seats and it has three ISOFIX points. So if you've got a lot of kids and all of them are child seat age, I mean, first up, well done to you for being so fertile. But the seven-seat option is what Hyundai's pointing towards because you can put child seats in the outboard second row captain's chairs and you can still walk through to the third row, put another kid in the back in a child seat there and have an extra seat or two for hangers-on, stragglers, or the fourth and fifth of your five children if you're really doing well on the child front. So I think... the versatility of it is definitely one of the draw cards, and the space in the back is good, if not quite full-on people mover level.
I think what's interesting about this car is it's 21 centimetres longer than the Santa Fe, which is already a relatively big car, but that means it still comes in under that magic 5-metre length mark, which means that you can actually park it in the average garage, because the problem with even bigger SUVs is that sometimes when you live in a normal-sized house, unless you've got a big yard out the front, you can't bloody park the thing. So there's an element of practicality there, which I like. Scully, I'm a little curious. This is very much a car that's geared towards the United States. I know it's built in Korea, but typically companies that make big Yank tanks like this can't find a way to get them in right-hand drive for Australia. So how the hell has Hyundai managed to pull off a coup and get that car to be made in right-hand drive for Australia? And are we the only country that you know of that actually has it in that configuration?
So Hyundai did make a big deal of the fact that we are pretty unique in our market for getting this car because initially it was left-hand drive only. I first saw it in Korea last year and it's big in the US as well. Hyundai didn't say exactly what segment share that it's going for with the car, but it did sort of say that this combined with the Santa Fe is going to grow its presence in the large SUV area pretty significantly. It also said that we're the first right-hand drive country in the world to get the car and we're the only one that's going to be capable of achieving any meaningful sales volume. So although it may go to Europe, Hyundai didn't confirm, and it doesn't really seem like a particularly fit car for Europe given how tight emission standards are and how tight the roads are over there. There might be a few right-hand drive countries around the world that get it in pretty limited numbers, but clearly Hyundai thinks there is a real opportunity for it to fill that gap between the Santa Fe and stuff like a Prado for people who want a big, comfortable car for all the kids in the family but don't want a proper off-roader that is going to be a little bit heavier and feel more like a truck to drive around town. And that is the word Hyundai used. They said they want families who want lots of space but don't want to feel like they're driving a truck.
So, Scott, you've already mentioned a couple of the mainstream competitors that the Palisade's up against. The Highlander, from memory, is what, 75,000 plus on roads for the diesel with all-wheel drive?
Correct.
So that's like, you know, very close to some premium large SUVs from Europe. Going by the spec and the, you know, the fit and finish and the space on offer and just the overall ambience that the Palisade offers, do you think that Hyundai is like seriously able to challenge some of the premium marks, given that now the price point is actually quite close to that area?
When it comes to space, yes, definitely. The interior of the Palisade really is like absolutely vast, and it is big and comfortable, and the second row is really good. So purely on capability, it definitely can. But in terms of the way it's screwed together and the stuff you get, it definitely feels nice. It's a very nice Hyundai, but it's not quite as premium inside, I would say, as the new Santa Fe, for example, which has some different color schemes and some nicer materials. It's also, everything up front is big and chunky. So the center console, for example, has a big flight deck feeling to it with big chunky buttons for the climate control and a big drive mode selector. And although it all works really well and it all feels really solidly put together, there definitely is a bit of a gap, I would argue, between the way that the Palisade looks and feels to the, I don't want to say proper premium, because premium is just an idea these brands want to push to a certain extent, but it doesn't quite feel like an XC90 or an X5 inside. I would argue in some ways that's a good thing, because people are going to sit in the Palisade and they're going to go, right, I get absolutely everything. It's all laid out really clearly in front of me. All the buttons are big and chunky and they can just hit the road and go. There's very little learning curve with the car. And if you've got kids screaming in the back and you're worried about where you need to be going and you're piloting a big car in the city, for some people, the idea of just it's simple, it works, but it still has all the tech, I would argue is quite appealing because, yeah, for me, the learning curve was pretty shallow. And I would imagine for a lot of, you know, people who are coming out of Hyundais or smaller cars, it's going to be the same story.
Now, Scully, it's running the four-banger diesel out of the Santa Fe, right? So the 2.2-litre four-cylinder diesel, which is punchy-ish in the Santa Fe, but how does it handle lugging along the bigger Palisade, which I presume is a fair bit heavier than the Santa Fe? Does it have enough guts? Because I know in the Carnival, it's sort of borderline. It's okay, but it's no rocket ship. And it looks like the sort of car that's crying out for a six-cylinder diesel just for that effortless grunt. Did it hold up its end okay?
It definitely falls into a similar category to the Carnival on that front. We drove a lot of miles on the highway. So we drove from Sydney to Canberra in the Palisade via some gravel back roads and bits and pieces. And obviously, once you're up at highway speed, it's very quiet, it's very settled, and it lugs along really nicely. The diesel is also, when you are up and moving, the transmission, although it's not the dual clutch from the Santa Fe, is smart enough and quick enough to drop you into the right gear at the right time so you can access peak torque. We didn't get a chance to load the car up fully. So I would say, based on my experience with it, it definitely has enough guts with two people on board and two big guys on board too. Neither of us are ballet dancers who were driving. But when you do have a full load of kids on board and luggage, and I know Hyundai did mention towing with this as well, it definitely would be on the less powerful side of things, which is another reason that that the premium brands maybe have a leg up, J-Bo, in response to your question earlier, because a V6 turbo diesel or an inline six turbo diesel like Mercedes is doing, although Hyundai doesn't necessarily have it available to it to put in the car, would really sort of make it feel, yeah, a little bit more upmarket again. So, yeah, the engine it's definitely adequate. And you're certainly not left with your foot to the boards waiting for it to take off. It's got enough grunt, but it also doesn't feel like there's a surfeit of power or torque that makes it feel completely effortless.
So you jumped out of the diesel and got into the petrol variant. How did you find that?
So the petrol, there are some people who just really don't enjoy diesel engines, or they don't feel like they need all-wheel drive. And the petrol is $5,000 cheaper than the diesel in the bottom-end Palisade and $4,000 cheaper in the top-end car. So on paper, it is the sort of family budget-friendly option. And it's also quite a nice thing. I mean, it's got 217 kilowatts and 355 newton meters on tap, and it's got that really nice, smooth kind of character that Hyundai's V6 does. But on one of the problems with it is that it's front-wheel drive only, and some of the time in the city that's going to be okay, but some of the driving we did was on sort of gravel back roads and up hills in less than perfect conditions, and occasionally the transmission would kick down one, then two, then three gears because you need some revs to get peak torque, and then the front wheels would spin a bit, which you just didn't get with the diesel. The other thing is, in the city, I mean, no big family SUV is going to be super efficient, but in the city, these naturally aspirated engines tend to be pretty thirsty. And on the highway, the diesel is a bit more relaxed and is going to use less fuel again. So the petrol is definitely there. And if you do like the sort of smooth and pretty easy feeling the petrol has in town, then it kind of makes sense. But for me, I think it's worth spending the extra $5,000 or $4,000 on the diesel because, for one, it's got all-wheel drive. And if you do ever take it to the snow or you feel the need to cross a muddy car park to get to a soccer game, for example, it's going to handle that a little bit better. But also, in my head, this is the sort of car that people are going to take and just point the nose up the Hume and drive from Melbourne to Sydney with the kids on board, for example. It's a really relaxed, comfortable highway cruiser, and the diesel suits that a little bit better than the petrol does.
Certainly sounds like an exciting new car for Hyundai. You can check out that review now live at carexpert.com.au. Scott Colley, thank you very much.
Thanks, guys.
Mike, you've put two of the most popular light cars in Australia, the Toyota Yaris and Kia Rio, head-to-head in our latest comparison. The Yaris is new and the Rio not so much. So how did they stack up?
Yeah, so it was quite widely covered this year that the new Toyota Yaris arrived, and probably the main headline story was its pricing. Massive price increases compared to the previous model in return for more specification and more tech, fairly, but still very price-sensitive end of the market. To be that expensive is going to be a challenge. The Kia Rio has become one of the regular top sellers in the class, so it did just get a minor update for the GT line that sits at the top of the range that I tested here, but it is fundamentally a slightly older design. But the rationale was, well, let's test this brand new Yaris against one of the established class toppers. So it was the Rio GT line, which is the top of the tree, 24,990 drive away. So I put it up against the Yaris SX, which sits in the middle of the range and, you know, which stacks up relatively well on paper. But then when you get down to the nitty-gritty of drive-away prices, it goes up to $39.90, so $6,000 more than the Rio, which is a lot of coin in this class. But then on top of that, I thought, well, you know, the Rio's got this little perky turbocharged three-cylinder engine, so it would be fair to put the premium engine in the Yaris as well. And the premium engine in the Yaris is a hybrid, a petrol-electric hybrid, which is unique for the class. That adds another $2,000 to the price. So suddenly you've got a mid-range Yaris at $32,990 drive away up against a top-of-the-range Rio for $24,990. So $8,000, that's 33% cost difference in one of the most cost-sensitive parts of the market. How the hell could the Yaris possibly win? Well, if you take away pricing, in actual fact, the Yaris does win quite convincingly. I guess the big question is, can you possibly take away pricing? So I think that the fundamentals of the Yaris are that it is absolutely loaded with safety tech. So every single Yaris in the range gets center airbags to protect the front two occupants from head clashes. It gets active lane assist. It gets autonomous emergency braking that can see cyclists. It gets active cruise control, the sort of features that you just wouldn't expect to get in a car in that class. Now, the Rio does get some of those features. So it does have a lane assist system and it does have AEB, but it does have a less sophisticated safety suite and an older five-star crash rating. Then you go into the interiors and look, the Kia Rio does have some good points. It's a little bit bigger than the Yaris and it's a little bit more spacious, which is always welcome. And it has a wireless Apple CarPlay and wireless Android Auto head unit, which, and I know, Wong, you've experienced the wireless phone mirroring tech. It's actually a brilliant thing, really good future-proofing. There were a couple of software glitches that I noticed, though, which were a bit unfortunate. It would occasionally crash, but hopefully they can sort of put out a bit of a software update and nip that problem in the bud. In terms of interior design, though, the Yaris does kind of win. It's really nicely put together. It's got a really interesting instrument display, a nice big touchscreen in the middle, slightly higher grade trim quality. Feels a little bit nicer, but you still left wondering whether the value could possibly stack up. Now, in terms of the way they drive, this is where the Yaris really starts to shine. So the three-cylinder turbo in the Rio, unfortunately, was a little bit down-tuned for this year. It used to have 88 kilowatts of power, but now it's got 74 kilowatts of power. It uses a bit less fuel than before, but not by much, alongside 172 newton meters of torque, and it uses a dual clutch automatic transmission. And like a lot of these engines, it's quite peppy. It's got a really distinctive raspy noise, but it's not exactly a rocket ship either. What's surprising is that the hybrid Yaris actually is a bit of a rocket ship, because you get that really nice electric power off the mark. So it's super smooth when you're taking off, and between 0 and 40 or 0 and 50, it's deceptively rapid. It was about 2 seconds quicker to 100 k's an hour than the ostensibly sporty-ish Rio GT line. So, and then on top of that, I drove the hybrid a little bit like Pop going to the bowls club, and I used 2.9 litres every 100 k's. And then I drove it like I'd stolen it, and, you know, that I was running from the cops frantically, and I used 5.1. So, you know, you just cannot get this car to use fuel. And of course, the Rio can't match that. So, you know, the fundamental finding that I had from this was that the Rio is kind of, in a sense, the old world light car, and that its value for money is unquestionable. But then the longer you spend with the Toyota, the more it starts to kind of make up for that price burden. And I copped a little bit of criticism in the comments of this piece, people saying, how can you possibly give the win to a car that's so much more expensive than its competitor? And that's a really fair question. So I actually sat down and crunched some numbers, and found that, you know, in terms of cost of ownership, the Yaris actually does make up ground. So forgive me for taking a bit of time here, but I think this is a pretty important point. So the grand total over 7 services for servicing the Yaris is $3,299, right? At 10,000 K intervals. The hybrid Yaris has much more generous servicing intervals of 15,000 Ks and much cheaper servicing. So you cover that 70,000 kilometer marker, and it costs you $975. So you save $2,200. Then it uses, off the ADR claims, 2 litres less fuel every 100 Ks than the Rio. If fuel was $1.50 a litre, that saves you $2,250 over 75,000 Ks. So fuel use and servicing, you've saved between $4,500 and $5,000 over the Rio, on top of an $8,000 price difference. Then you factor in Toyota's typical resale value. Then you factor in the fact that hybrid cars hold their value better because they're more future-proof. And suddenly you start to get a picture of total cost of ownership rather than just the sticker price that you pay. This is the sort of thing that big fleet buyers have known for a long time, which is you can't just look at the price. You have to look at the total cost of ownership over the period that you have the car. And the Yaris really does claw things back. And I was really happy to sort of see that, yes, the price is very high, but it's not the exorbitant ripoff that it appears to be once you've actually spent some time with the car. So, yeah, in short, the Rio, a decent little car, 7.5 out of 10, does what it has to do. But the Yaris, despite that price, 8 out of 10, and the clear winner in every area but one.
So it was certainly a pretty narrow win, though, to the Yaris. How did you find the space in both the cars, the cabin space?
Yeah, look, I mean, these cars are both small, about 4 meters long, and that is definitely one area where the Rio comes out on top. Slightly better back seats. Still, you're not going to be carrying two big adults back there with a huge amount of regularity, but if you had to get in the back of either of these cars for a drive, it would definitely be getting into the back of the Rio, and it also has a slightly bigger boot. So I don't know how many people are buying these little cars with practicality first and foremost in their mind, but if you do need that little bit of space, the Rio does well. But then again, neither of them are a patch on the Honda Jazz when it comes to practicality. So, you know, I guess it depends how far you want to take it.
Moko, you sort of said already that the Yaris is quite significantly ahead of the Rio in most areas, bar price and also the rear seat space and boot space, as you just mentioned. When the Rio was revealed in its facelifted form, albeit very minor facelift, the European model got a few extra features that would probably line up better against the Yaris. So it got things like adaptive cruise control with lane follow assist and blind spot monitoring with rear cross traffic alert, which our model still doesn't get, and then some mild hybrid tech to go with it. If Kia were able to bring a car with that sort of stuff in it that would probably much better line up with the Yaris. Do you think the Kia could have perhaps clawed a win if the price still stayed under that $30,000 mark?
Maybe, yeah, maybe. I think if it had those extra features, I guess you get down to the point though where, you know, the price does start to climb pretty high. I think the hybrid Yaris feels like a $5,000 better car as it stands. So if Kia was able to add those things, then there's no doubt that it would be a much more closely fought battle. And, you know, at the end of the day, I'm not saying that the Kia is necessarily something that you shouldn't look at. It's disappointing that its drivetrain, you know, went backwards, and it's disappointing that it misses out on some features that the European one gets, but it's not without its charms. I think it's actually a better looking car than the Yaris as well, for what it's worth, although that is, strictly speaking, very subjective. But it doesn't feel like a sort of 24,990 driveaway light car. It feels worth a little bit less than that in a lot of ways, which kind of is because, you know, the base models are a lot cheaper. So if I was recommending a Rio, I'd be inclined to recommend one of the lower grade ones that are genuinely spectacularly good value for money. So sort of your 17, 18, 990 entry level Rios for me make more sense. Whereas if you're after a more premium feeling light car, and there are plenty of people that are, that's where the premium price Yaris starts to really come into its own.
Right.
Which car do you think was the most fun to drive?
I actually love driving that Yaris. And look, I know people think, you know, I guess I am copping flack because I like the car so much despite that price tag, but it is a genuinely fun car to drive. All the new Toyota stuff on their TNGA platform drives really nicely. You know, Toyotas used to be as inspiring as tissue boxes to drive. They had no verve, no character, no anything really, except for their sports cars. But the new one actually is really nippy, really agile. The Kia is a warmed-up hatchback. The one area where the Kia is far better dynamically is the tyres it's running. It's running these Continental tyres that are fantastic, whereas the Yaris is on these crappy Eco tyres that just let go the second you attack a corner with a bit too much veracity. So that's the first thing I'd be doing, is swapping the tyres. But, you know, tyres aside, the way it rides, it's a bit quieter over bumps, a bit quieter over coarse chip surfaces, a bit more eager with its directional changes. And that hybrid drivetrain just suits a little car so well. It's really punchy off the mark. The instant response from the electric side of things, electric motor is there. It's dead silent. It stands still. I mean, you're in stop-start traffic all the time, as we know, in cars like this. And it's quicker too. So definitely from a fun point of view, it's, weirdly enough, the hybrid Yaris that takes the cake.
Very, very cool. You can read the comparison now up at carexpert.com.au and, let Mike know what you think of the results in the comments below.
Yeah, jump in the comments and tell me I'm an idiot. There are a lot of people that are, and in all honesty, I take it on board. I had a feeling that me giving the win to the most expensive city car of all time, notwithstanding the Mini lineup, would be controversial, and it has proven to be the case. So go and let me know what you think.
That brings an end to this week's podcast. We are approaching Christmas and the New Year break, but we've still got cars coming through the garage. What's coming up next week, J-Wo?
We have the updated Alfa Romeo Giulia Veloce. We have an Audi TT RS, a Ford Escape Vignale, a Ford Mustang GT convertible, a Skoda Kamiq. Those are all in Melbourne. In Sydney, we also have the Audi RS4 Avant and the Audi A5 Sportback. And in Brisbane, currently booked in, we have an Audi S7 Sportback as well, but no doubt Albors will probably wrangle something together as well.
I'm just going through the calendar for the first time for the Christmas break, and there's a real Ingolstadt flavour in our garage, isn't there? There's a lot of Audis.
Yeah, there's quite a few, isn't it? It's like Audi is a lovely Christmas gift.
Well, Audi's launched about 147 new cars this year, and we've only driven about half of them. So we're frantically trying to get through all of their new products. Every year it's a brand that has a massive rollout. Next year it'll be some other brand, Mercedes or BMW, no doubt, but it's Audi's turn this year. So, yeah.
Yeah. If you would like to get in touch with us, if you have any questions or feedback, that email address is podcast@carexpert.com.au. The second last podcast for the year for us. Mike Costello and James Wong, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mandy.
Always a pleasure, Mandy.